Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Musicals Told Me Everything I Know, the podcast where we talk about musicals and all of the things that they teach us. I am your host, Zane C. Weber, here with regular host
Miranda Selwood.
And that's it, just the two of us today, because the other people are doing other people things, and we don't want to know what that is, because it's not talking about musicals.
No.
But we have a very special guest with us today. We have none other than
Miranda Toya.
How are you going?
Very well, thanks. Yeah. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah?
Pretty good. So, we are talking about a musical today.
Mm. Yes.
And that musical's name is?
It is The King and I.
Otherwise known as Randit and Miranda.
The Randit and Miranda Show.
Exactly, yes. Right. That's why we got you in, because you, of course, are I and Miranda is the king.
Pretty close.
Yes.
Pretty
almost,
close.
Almost.
50-50.
That's it. Toss that coin.
We did the show fairly recently. In
2 years ago?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Actually, I had the shirt out the other day. It's 2017.
2017.
Wow, 4 years ago.
Wow, that is a long time. Randit, of course, played King. I played the role of I. And my niece Astrid, shout out to Astrid, played one of your many children.
Yes.
Yes.
And also was my son was there and my nephew as well.
Yeah, it was a real family affair. It was fun.
A little strangely, one of my wives was my sister.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
It was a bit awkward.
But let's not dwell on it too much. Let's get to know a little bit about you and hopefully not too much about you and your sister.
It is now time for my favorite moment to sing this song on this episode. Getting to know you, getting to know all about you. And today we went with a much more character appropriate getting to know you rendition.
It was very, very pretty and lyrical.
Did it bring back some memories for you, Randit?
It did. It brought memories back from a very long time ago. So from when I first started on stage, my first show was The King and I.
Wow.
And I was the youngest kid. and that began everything for me. So yes, that song has very warm feelings for me.
Aww. Mm.
Well, enough of that sap. Which musical character would other people compare you to?
Oh, this I really struggled with this one, actually. I had to speak to my wife and go, what would you say? Because I didn't have a clue. she reckons Kristoff, as long as he's the one with the moose.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, or the caribou. I'm not sure what animal it is.
Kristoff is the one,
reindeer.
One of the reindeer, yeah.
One of the reindeer.
No, yeah. Oh, the one with the reindeer. With the reindeer.
Cool,
yeah.
Because
reindeers are better than people.
Yes.
He's the ice merchant.
That's true. That's right. So, yes, I couldn't think for myself on that one.
No, that's what that one's about. What do you think other people would compare you to?
Yeah, and I was too scared to send a message to my daughter asking her, because it would just be not worth it.
Well, what musical character would you like other people to compare you to?
I would love people to compare me to Cosmo Brown from Singing in the Rain.
What's your tapping like?
I'm a tap dancer.
Excellent. Well, there you go. You're halfway there.
So, yes.
Randit
it
is
would be amazing.
A very accomplished tap dancer. A skill which, unfortunately, we were unable to put into The King and I.
Yes. But,
I'm sure you petitioned pretty hard for it, though.
No, there were some moments where I was like, waltz, 2-3, waltz, 2-3, tap a tap a tap a tap a 2-3. I think it would have worked.
We could have got it in. And then Ben, the MD, was talking the whole time about trying to get it in there.
Yeah.
So, I would love to write a version of this with some tap dancing.
Look, as long as no one knows about it, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah.
What is your dream role?
Oh, that's a tough one. definitely. A lot of the roles I've always wanted to play have always come from the fact that I've got brown skin. All the people that I saw in the shows that I used to watch, like all the leads were all white people.
Of course, yeah.
And so all of these roles, like the king, and that those are all the roles that I looked at as a kid and went, "Whoa, I could do that one. I could do that one." So most of the big roles that I still would like to play are all. So I'd love to play Emil in South Pacific.
Yeah.
I thought that'd just be great. I would really like to play Tevye. That would be very cool.
Nice.
He's a gun. And I don't really think I got the musical chops for it, but I would love to do Javert. He is freaking awesome.
I think Tevye and
if Russell Crowe can play Javert, anybody can play Javert.
Well, that's,
are we saying that Russell Crowe played Javert?
Oh, good point. Good point. Sorry. No, you're right.
Yeah. Yes. No, I can definitely see you as a Javert.
I can't, you know, because you're too lovable. I don't want to squash on your dreams, but unfortunately your smile is too smiley and your face is too happy.
Well, if you just didn't smile.
That's true.
You can't.
I'm
going
to smile. Yeah, I'm about to smile.
See?
He was the happiest king that's ever been in the kingdom.
Okay, well, what is your favorite Sondheim show?
Growing up a dancer, it's always been West Side Story for me.
Yes.
It's always been. And again, there's lots of brown people in that. I could be in that one. and then probably a very close second would be... on a blank now.
Company. Into the Woods.
No.
Merrily.
No.
Gypsy.
What's this?
Miranda has a vested interest in what your pick is.
I can't remember.
Sweeney Todd.
God, yeah, that's it. I'm sitting there thinking, Fleet Street. So, come on, what is it? I did a show years ago that was a tribute to Sondheim, and I got to sing a song in there, and I was like, "Whoa, that was really cool!" And then we did some of the stuff from Sweeney Todd, and I was like, blown away.
Yeah, what's your go-to shower song at the moment?
It is Mr. Bojangles. Surprise, surprise!
Yeah.
I mean, having just met you, I am surprised, but you know, knowing that you're a tap dancer, maybe I'm not so surprised. Okay, so this is the controversial question, question that you must answer, and you must answer definitively.
Sure.
You have to delete one musical from existence. It can never have been made. It can never be made again. And it can't be Cats, because Cats is already dead.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah, it is.
I didn't even need to get halfway through this question to know the answer for me. It's The Sound of Music.
Wow, okay.
I know. So many people hate me because of it. But it's
that particularly offends you?
Oh, I think a lot of it is all the stuff with the kids.
Which so, is the terrible, movie.
Which is terrible because my daughter was in it years ago. And I ended up going to watch it four or five times. And I was just...
You are a good father. That's what you are.
Yeah.
Yes, thank
you. I mean, I think if you had to go watch a show that you weren't really into four or five times, it might weigh you down.
Yeah.
It might weigh you down.
A little.
Yeah. I don't know. It's such a staple in a period that was a turning point for musical theatre. I can't touch them. You can't.
Unfortunately, Miranda, I know. We can and we have. And it's gone.
Yeah, I would be touching it all the way out. Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of staples that have been thrown out in very similar fashion.
That's true. And in fact, Rodgers and Hammerstein does get a little bit of a kick every now and then.
Yeah. Not unfairly.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I'm not allowed to argue with the guests, so for that reason and that reason alone.
All right. Well,
we'll allow you to move on.
I think we know everything that we need to know about Raindit. So what we're going to do is we're going to play some music and we'll come back and we will start talking about the king and his eye. So I think first off, we need to start with the staple, which is 2 minutes to give us the entire plot and character summary of The King and I.
And just to be clear, Raindit, the king and I and all the other characters.
Other people, not just
your plot.
Story arc.
Yes, okay. There was a king. Yeah. We were joking about this earlier.
I mean, if you could list... If you spend this time listing just the king, the names of all of his wives and the names of all of his children, I would be equally impressed.
Do they even have names?
I don't think so.
If you've played the role, you should have given
them
names.
No, the children. The children.
I don't.
They're like number one. Literally. Anyway.
Actually, okay. That's how...
The youngest one.
My king numbered the wives. We went 1, 2, 3. Oh, Lady Tiang had a name and then the rest
everyone
were...
Everyone else.
Number two. Number
wife
two.
Wife number. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Go.
Okay. So there's Anna. Comes from Britain to Siam to teach the children and the wives of the king. She meets the Kuala home, who is the prime minister and the king's chief lackey. He takes them to the palace where they are to live. But of course, Anna objects because, you know, she's got it in her mind that she needs a house as well. The king ignores her, obviously, because he's the king and that's what he does, and introduces her to Lady Tiang, his head wife, all of his children, and also Tup Tim, who is a gift from Burma. Gift of a woman from Burma, that's correct. Anna goes about teaching the kids all things about the importance of things like having a house, which obviously gets the back of the king up. And amongst other things, geography and science. So they learn about snow and that, which the Prince Chulalongkorn doesn't believe is true, of course, because he's lived his whole life in Thailand, or Siam at the time. Oh, what else are we going? The king and Anna get into it over some minor contract issues, being the house. You know, he was obviously thinking she was doing this job for exposure, but apparently not. Meanwhile, Tup Tim has been secretly seeing her love, Lun Ta, who is the guy who brought her from Burma. And Anna, I think, spots that happening and kind of gets involved. The king hears that the British are coming, and he's obviously worried that they're going to try and take over the country, really. So he chats with Anna about it, who convinces him to put his best foot forward, cue funny moments, and receive them with European-style banquet, dressing the wives in European clothes, cue more funny moments. An old flame of Anna's arrives in the delegation, which sparks jealousy in the king. And I'm out of time, aren't I?
Yeah.
Oh.
Here you are. We'll never know what happens.
Yeah. The king's jealous.
And then the king dies.
Then the king dies.
And Anna stays.
That's right.
She's the queen.
I feel like we probably do need to cover the climactic point of the show, which is the bit we've missed there.
Yes.
So the British are coming. The British are coming. And we're going to throw a party because we need to make the natives look as British as possible for the Britons to accept them and believe that they can run their own country. The times they were.
The Britons are the small-minded ones here.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
Absolutely. Yes. Continue from there.
Well, they continue on from there. They put on a play or a ballet in which Tup Tim kind of has a go at the king, and then she promptly disappears. The king's upset with the show, obviously, because it makes him out to be a barbarian and all the things that he didn't want the Britons to think about him. Afterwards, Anna and the king are discussing Tup Tim's runaway, and she explains her unhappiness at being just another woman. The king explains that that's just the natural order of things, obviously, being the king and a man.
Because there's bees and there's flowers
and
that sort of thing.
That's correct.
You don't
need
to understand it. You're a woman.
Yes.
Hashtag science.
Yeah, that's it. And then Anna explains her feelings about one man and one woman. They get into a dance. Cue the spontaneous applause, which comes from doing a simple polka.
It's not simple when it has that many turns in it.
Very heartbreaking as a dancer to get spontaneous applause for that.
I could do 100 wings in a row. No.
No.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Yeah, that's all you can.
And then the big thing happens where they find out that Tup Tim has been caught and the king is going to whip her for dishonoring him. And Anna throws herself in the end physically in between the king and Tup Tim to stop the whipping, which does something not stated to the king, and he runs away. Then it continues on that Anna decides, I'm out of here. This is enough. I'm gone. Lady Tiang comes down and catches her just before she leaves and gives her a letter from the king where he says that he respects her and all of those sorts of things and thanks her deeply for all of her hard work. And she comes rushing back to the palace to see him basically hand over to the prince and die. And that's about it.
It's a beautiful show. Mm. The very happy end.
I mean, by the way that you said does something not stated, it definitely sounds like Anna poisoned the king.
Well, in a way, she poisoned him with education.
With reason.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Poisoned him with civilization? Question mark?
Well, no, not necessarily that, but it's just, you know, she came from a world that's completely different, with completely different expectations of human behavior and what's good and right, and they essentially, the king and Anna, come to argue about that over and over and over again, just constantly. Yeah. And I think in that moment, it's the moment where the king relinquishes that fight.
Yes.
He would you say he surrenders in a way to say, obviously...
Yeah. Yeah, I think obviously had Anna not been there, he would have whipped her. Not a question at all. Yeah. She would have copped it really badly. And Anna...
Because that's normal and right.
Turned a mirror on himself. Mm. Yeah, that's right. And I think she turned a mirror on himself at the time when he was the most stuck in his ways of his traditional ways and all of his upbringing and everything. She shone a light to him on that right as he was doing it, and he saw it.
Yeah.
And it hurt him.
It shattered his poor little soul.
Yeah. Because I think...
That's what it did.
I thought as I was like learning fatally. About the character.
Fatally. Yeah. See, that's a little bit of a confusion. Like, yeah, yeah. We've done the show and we're like... I don't know. His heart broke. Yes. is how it's often referred.
I would also just imagine like he had a heart attack or a stroke or something, and it was like,
well, there's a lot of stress involved in realizing you're not the person you think you are.
Especially if he's the king and he's wrong, and so everything is wrong.
So the show is Rodgers and Hammerstein, obviously. Unless that's not obvious to you, in which case I've just taught you that. It's Rodgers and Hammerstein, and it's one of the earlier ones in their canon. So this, I want to say, this is pre-Oklahoma, which is sort of recognized as the turning point of their move into highly political statement theater, in a sense, as much as Rodgers and Hammerstein does. But it's also a precursor to South Pacific in a lot of ways, and take, you know, this idea of looking at how different cultures exist in the world, and prejudice and racism is actually something that Rodgers and Hammerstein attempted over and over again to take on, and attempted to give a positive light. And we look back at it now and go, oh, gee, but is And this is one of those shows where you can clearly see that the show is displaying and portraying the Taiwanese at the time.
Siamese.
Sorry, I just think of cats when I say that. It's terrible. as a holistic people who have good values. They're just not the values of Western culture.
Yeah.
And working on the show, I think you find that a lot more, and that these arguments between the king and Anna, which basically are marking points throughout the show, are just that clash of cultures.
Yeah.
And it's exacerbated by then that next level of the sexism well, Anna is just a woman.
I think that's like when we were reading through, just before we started recording, we were reading through some of the things that have been said, and it's like it was described as a romance, and we were all like, is it?
No. And this is actually one of the questions that's often brought up about this show, and particularly the ending of the show. It's like, is there something going on between Anna and the king? Are they romantically involved? And this all comes to a head in the famous scene from this show. If you ask anybody about the king and I, they'll tell you about a giant dress and a shoeless king dancing this huge circular dance that gets wild and out of control. But the beautiful thing about that dance is it's such a connecting moment between their two personalities. Mm. So the polka in itself and then the concept of a man and woman dancing in this way, ballroom dancing, is a very Western proper, you know, ideal, and it's something that's usually very, you know, perfect
poised.
Yeah. Yes. And then the king has this raw energy that he brings to the polka, and they end up having this beautiful blended moment of their two energies. And I think that's what really strikes people about that scene.
I think it definitely reads, as someone who hasn't done the show, as they are drawn to each other, but there isn't any like nothing ever happens either off screen or on.
No.
But it's like, I think if Anna was a man, I don't think the story and the ideas that were playing out would have developed in the same way. As the fact that Anna is a woman, and then him having to reconcile how he thinks about women and how he thinks about Anna at the end.
Mm.
And I think that is kind of communicated through that attraction and being drawn to each other between a man and a woman. So I think there is an element of, like, in inverted commas, romance, but it is definitely a couple of tiers below the ideas that they represent and they're trying to kind of communicate to each other. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sounds fair.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I wouldn't write it off as a romance, but I definitely wouldn't describe it primarily as a romance.
No. There's definitely something between the two of them.
Yeah.
They have a very, I would say by the end, they have a very deep connection.
Mm. But it's,
whether
it's
romantic or whether it's just
intellectual sort of.
Yeah, because they're sparring partners all the way through.
Yes.
But that
is a classic romance storyline, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, well,
I pull your hair because I like you.
Yeah, yeah. I hate you until I kiss you, and then we like each other, and then you do something bad, and I hate you again, and then at the end, we get married.
Yeah. 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 So, as is almost unusual for a musical in the 1940s, no one gets married at the end of this show. And some people might even tell you that means it's not a musical, because that's one of the ingredients of a musical is the wedding at the end. It is based, I want to say loosely, on Margaret Landon's novel Anna and the King of Siam, which is based even more loosely on the real-life memoirs of Anna Lyons. Never really learned how to pronounce her name, which is very sad for me. Lyons. Sounds good to me.
Anna is close, isn't it?
Yeah. Who was actually the governess to the children of the King of Siam in the 1860s. And that is when it's set. It's set in period. And honestly, that's one of the things that I think actresses and designers really love about this show. And it
why would that be?
Big dresses and opulent sets. And
yes.
The original production was specifically known for the big set and all the production values. It was a huge thing. And it was very oriental in a 1940s, 1950s way.
The Western view of oriental.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what attracted a lot of people to it, because it had this amazing exotic oriental design and feel about it. And I think considering the time that it was written and looking at it through that lens of it's an Oriental-inspired production of the 1940s, the King of Siam, and particularly his head wife, are actually written very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they have revised the script a fair bit in more recent revivals. But, Randy, you were saying before that it seems they actually put back in stuff.
Yes.
Rather than...
I was reading in preparation for this, I was reading one of the reviews. And in the review of the one at the Palladium in London, the guy writes that the script reinstates some lines from a discarded draft, which makes the characters political political predicament more pronounced. He mentions, should he open his country up to foreign influence and everything? Or should he perhaps just build a wall around it and not let anyone in?
Should he trump it?
And I thought, wow. I just had to check and it was like 2018.
I mean, I'm sure a wall would work. Like,
if you could build the whole thing, you know?
Oh, dear.
I just cracked up, though, when I read that. I was like, oh.
And such is the great ongoing significance of the King and I.
Well, speaking of ongoing significance, it won the Tony Award in its first year in 1952. Mm-hmm. It didn't win in the 77 Broadway revival, but in the 85 revival, it won. Well, Yul Brynner won his special Tony Award for King and I.
For being the king his entire life.
For his entire life. And in the 96, it won the best revival of a musical, as well as did in 2015. So, like, It's probably, I have yet to find, I've done some cursory research, but I can't find another musical whose revivals have consistently won Tony Awards.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think a lot of that has to do with the strength of the characters in the writing and the amazing design opportunities in this show. Yeah. And I was looking at some, I found an article called The King and I Revivals Important Message, and I thought, here's a shortcut for some lessons I learned for that singer. But it's actually mostly about the latest revival and how they basically started from scratch on the people's expectation, particularly around the design. So what they did is make it more realistic in a lot of ways. They went back to looking for genuine period appropriate costuming and set designs. They made the clothes look spectacular, but in a far more simplistic and natural way. And you look at photos of those designs, and there's a Tony Awards performance, I think, from this production that includes particularly a large group of the wives, and you look at the detail in their costuming and things, and it's really quite amazing. And it's the simplicity that has made it so beautiful. It's not garish.
Yeah.
And I think that's what some previous productions had, you know, I dare not say suffered from, because people loved it. But they didn't strip down the cast in any way. They, in fact, made it bigger. They made the orchestra a lot bigger, so the orchestration sounds so lush and full. And they really put a lot of thought into getting the casting right and going with the right people. There was no stunt casting involved in this situation. It wasn't like, oh, let's get Yul Brynner back again, you know?
We want bums on seats.
Bums on seats, Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
So this is the production starring Kelly O'Hara, and she's just absolutely perfect in this role.
Yeah.
I struggle to think of anybody who could ever have done it better. And I think that she's so genuine to Anna's background and personality without making her a brash obstacle to the king. Which, again, I think is something that is an easy go-to.
Yeah.
But she struggles throughout this whole show just as much as the king does with that clash of culture and not being able to communicate or understand. Yep. And I think she's just perfect.
I think we are edging towards some lessons we've learned.
Oh, no, but we have to talk so much more about the show. Oh, my God.
Well, talk about it in lessons that we've learned.
No, I don't want to. I want to talk about it now.
Which we will be going to after this little piece of music.
Okay.
Now, whatever you wanted to say, just phrase it as a lesson, like on Jeopardy instead of a question.
I actually learnt the storyline in a vague sense of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a famous classic American novel that is used as the basis of the Siamese ballet.
Yep.
the performance that the wives and children and people put together for the English, which is an amazing sequence.
Yeah.
Amazing. Beautiful choreographic moment. Classic. It takes the place in the Rodgers and Hammerstein format of the dream ballet.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'd written in my notes when I was thinking about the plot.
Yeah.
And I went, it's got to have that either dream sequence or show within a show. And that's where it is.
And it's both.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is why it won the Tony Award. Yeah.
Well, it's funny going back to that. Like, I, doing my research, the Tony Award for Best Revival only started being awarded in the 90s. So the two revivals before that were very well thought of because they kind of went on to West End and Yul Brynner won that award. So, like, technically you could say that it always won the revival, but Tony Awards only started being given in 94, which for Best Revival, which is something that I learned.
Nice.
Good job.
Also, Yul Brynner was played this forever. Like, I knew that he was famous for playing it, but, like, he did play it forever and ever.
He did.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
And, of course, Yul Brynner is the king that you see in the film.
Yes. Yes, the 56 film.
The 56 film. I would have assumed Julie Andrews had played this role. In fact, wait a minute. I've got a recording of Julie Andrews singing this role. Never played it. Only did a studio recording.
Just recorded it.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
I learned that. I was like, what?
When did they do a studio record? When was the studio recording? That was it part of a show? Like, could the actress just not do it? Just
no, they were just like, I'm going to make a studio recording of The King and I with Julie Andrews.
Huh. All right. Who played the king? Was it Yul Brynner?
Yul Brynner.
Yep. Okay, so we don't know, but we can assume.
I got to look up who was the king. 1992 studio cast. John Masseri.
Okay. John Masseri.
Oh, no, he was the conductor. Wait. Ben Kingsley.
Oh.
It was Ben Kingsley.
Wow, actually.
I recognised his face.
I've heard that recording.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it.
It's actually my preferred recording.
Yeah.
The wonderful thing about this recording is that it is the complete score.
Oh.
So the movie soundtrack and the previous recording had omitted some of the songs. The movie soundtrack in particular omitted some songs, including some one of Anna's solos, which I take personal exception to. But it was included in this recording in 1992 studio cast. There you go.
All right. Yeah. Well, I got some lessons from this. I like I was saying earlier, I needed to look at this a lot more deeply than I normally do, and look at it from the outside in rather than someone who's playing a role and building where they fit within the whole story. And it's funny because I, you know, having done it when I was little, and then doing it again as an adult, and just going, I learnt just so much from the show, just the difference looking at it from a child to an adult even. But yeah, then I really looked at it and went, okay, so what kind of lessons can you take from this? And I just went, well, obviously you can't not start with women can do anything. Like, Anna is a total badass. Like, she goes into somewhere where anyone would speak up like that, they'd probably get beaten. And she just goes, no, I'm standing my ground and I'm just going to do it. And she
But also she does it without sacrificing her own definition of femininity.
Yeah.
So, like, she's a strong character who knows what she wants and knows what she's about, but she doesn't shed her ideas of, like, what a woman is and what a woman can do to do that.
Yeah.
Which is usually a part of the story, is, like, a woman having to take on masculine traits to achieve something beyond womanhood.
Yeah.
Where I think that's Anna's big strength, is, like, she achieves her goals through femininity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought...
Yes, she does.
And I thought, having written it so long ago, I was like, wow, that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so there was a little bit in there. I don't know if it's colonialism is the word, but all those things around the king being, he wouldn't say afraid, but afraid that the British are going to come and take over his country. Like,
see, that's the thing, because I think this musical, while colonialism is, like, the threat of this musical. I don't think it's really discussed much as like what that would mean. I think this is much more of a culture clash musical where you have two equals, Anna and the King, kind of discussing the different ways that their two cultures differ. And
particularly the morality of their cultures.
Yeah, and like trying
because
to figure out...
Because this is the thing. They both think they're good people doing the right thing by their people.
Yeah.
But they look at each other going, how can you treat people like that?
Yeah, and it's
think
really...
it's the right thing to do.
I can't actually think of another musical that does it in such a way where two equal status characters have this ongoing discussion about what is right and what is wrong and like the pressures of why they think that above and beyond their own logic and emotion.
Yeah. I think one of the things to remember is that the King, and it's not as present in the musical as it is in some other forms of this story, but the King wanted an English governess to, he wanted to learn about, he wanted his people.
Yeah.
This is the thing. He sort of already knew these things are a bit beyond me because I have not been brought up with any of this understanding, but I want my people to be modern and capable and scientific. He's always on about this science thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a great lesson to learn from this is like you have to decide to learn something. You can't be forced to learn something. Like the King made the choice to like, I need to learn about these things. I'm going to find someone to educate. Well, I want my people to learn through me.
And my son, he wanted his son to be the best king to carry their country and their culture and their world and their people through what was obviously a changing world.
Yeah.
And the fact that he recognized that makes him not the, you know, uncultured native that
the uncivilized brute.
Yeah, he's not an uncivilized brute at all.
He was worried about being viewed as.
He wants education and he wants his country to grow and be, you know, stand on its own.
He was progressive thinking as much as he could be.
He was progressive thinking.
Growing up as a
but
king.
He didn't like, have the resources
Well, that's the thing. He was progressive thinking. He just didn't know what he was progressing into.
Yeah.
And so he had to learn what that was. And
he also had those parts that he couldn't go, oh, I can progress here, but I can't progress on this thing.
Yeah.
So, which is one of the other lessons that I took from it, that it takes time. Progressive values and things take time to get into place. And you see it at the end when he watches his son, and his son straight away says, I don't want people bowing anymore.
Mm.
And he sees that going forward into the next generation. And so,
I think what you just said is absolutely correct. The King basically passing the torch at the end is basically him recognizing, like, I can't progress any further, but I can allow my people and my family to do that on behalf of me. Like, there is the irresistible force and immovable like object, well, the immovable object is going to remove itself, so that the irresistible force can do its business.
And I think that, you know, that scene at the end where he sees his son and he speaks to Anna for the last time and then he passes curtain.
Yeah.
Like, it's really hard to just turn that off and happy bows now. Let's put on some bow music and get it, you know. It's a
Mega
weird, it's a weird moment. It's not a traditional happy ending, but it is a positive resolution for the show.
Yeah. And both characters.
They definitely made their peace.
And to have this understanding between them that you know, he's glad that she is going to be there to help Toulon-Corn take this next step. Yeah. And the recognition that from her that he was always trying to do the best good thing that he was a good father and, you know, he was a good leader to his people.
He had lots of practice being a father, so.
Well, what are their names again? Sorry.
There's Toulon-Corn and then number two, number three, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, that is what the most famous quote from The King and I.
Now, I'm sure you learn, you know how to dance in hoop skirts, Miranda.
I do now.
Or did you learn that from this show?
I don't know that Look, when we were in rehearsal, the skirt was not a problem because I was just wearing the hoops. Okay? Yeah. When we got into costume and there was a giant satin dress, a petticoat.
Yeah, yeah.
So the hoops, the petticoat, the giant satin dress over it. Suddenly there was a lot more weight.
Yeah.
And once you start that thing moving... it makes me think of that story about Fred and Ginger. I don't know whether you can relate to this, given the giant weight of material smacking into your legs during that dance. But there's a beautiful, famous routine that Fred and Ginger did, and Ginger Rogers is wearing a dress made out entirely of feathers. This just this huge long skirt made of feathers, and you know, they're filming it. She's spinning and spinning and spinning, and the feathers are just going everywhere. And that is has been documented as Fred Astaire's least favorite dance to film, even though it's this beautiful number that's gone down in history as one of their most recognizable routines.
Yeah. So you're just breathing in feathers the whole time.
Because he's getting smacked in the legs with feathers and breathing them in, and just feathers everywhere. Yeah.
And then imagine having to dance in it. Like,
yeah, that's right. But I just... That learning, that scene was fun, but I think we kind of got to this point where like, I have no idea how many turns I've done anymore.
Yeah.
My feet are just going in the rhythm and we're turning and you're moving so fast. It's really hard to just time the point at which you stop.
Yeah, it's that release at the end.
The dancing is the hard part. The stopping is the hard part.
And also because when that release happens, Anna just has to spin still across the stage and end up on the one piece of scenery that's there to fall on.
And casually fall on this one specific spot.
Oh, I have a vape.
Yeah, of course, falling open to the audience so they can see her face.
Gracefully, falling gracefully.
Yeah.
Yes, and the dress must land perfectly to look, because you can't, like, you have to do the rest of that very serious scene in that one position. That's very important.
We can't have the hoop up in your face.
No.
Do you want a funny story about a hoop skirt that happened to the King and I?
I feel we need a funny story about the hoop skirt.
So sometimes... I don't want to say all the time, but specifically this one performance. I guess the bow on the lacing through the top of the hoop skirt wasn't very secure because we were in the scene, also quite a famous scene that involves
in the temple,
the book and the writing of the letter.
Yeah.
And it's that whole thing about the Anna must always be at the level below the king. So he, you know, sits and then he bows and then he gets right down on the floor and she's got to stay, you know, on his level. So there's a lot of getting up and down and weirdness things. And particularly that last moment where they're lying on the floor at the end and the hoop skirt is popped up at the back is a really recognizable moment that the audience expects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Anyway, we're partway through that scene. My hoop skirt is now halfway down my thighs. And I'm like trying to walk with my legs wide open to stop it from going past my knees. And it's slipping and it's slipping. I'm like, I just need to go off stage and get a pencil. I didn't say that, but I can't even remember what it was that got me off stage. But I had to run off stage, let the hoop skirt go and jump back on.
Yeah. And it was that was the scene also that we had so much troubles in rehearsals.
Yes.
And we kept walking backwards and forwards and these lines just kept almost repeating themselves. And so we'd go through and then we'd either jump forward a whole heap or we'd just go back to where we had started.
How did we end up here again? Yeah.
So, yes, it was...
It was actually a confusing scene to learn.
Yeah.
And it's one of those scenes where the through thought just changes direction suddenly over and over again.
Yeah.
So it was difficult.
It was fun, though.
All right. Well, do we have any other lessons or should we move on to
there
casting?
There are so many lessons. Yeah. Don't stand in the way of young love. It never works out. Just don't do it. If somebody wants to marry somebody they're in love with, don't be like, no, you're a gift to me from
Burma. You are literally deleting the majority of musical theatre canon right now.
I'm not deleting it. I'm just saying don't do it.
It won't happen. If no one stands in front of young love, the where's musicals the story? Don't happen. West Side Story? Okay.
Oh, no, I said, where is the story? Oh.
Yeah, West Side Story. They just get married, I guess.
It's true.
And end of Act 1.
But that's my point.
Yeah.
You know, that's all of those musicals are trying to teach you that lesson.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. They love each other. Leave them be.
I'm not gonna say no.
Education is key.
Yeah. Mm. That's the main thing about this whole show is, like, if you don't expose yourself to other thoughts, you're not going to be a fully rounded person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
Thank you.
Very succinct. You can tell in the way that we all just went quiet.
Zane's advice, everyone, is to expose yourself to more.
To other people's ideas and thoughts and ways of viewing the world. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Not just expose yourself.
Try not to expose yourself to too many make America great again
ideas.
People. But, yeah, you know, like, one, just to figure out why that is a problem.
Yeah. Well, I think that the King / Yul Brynner made the good choice. Instead of building a wall, he introduced and invited in education and knowledge and freedom of thought.
Take that, Trump.
In your face.
Trump needs to sit down and watch The King and I.
He needs to have sat down and watched The King and I a while ago.
He'd be sitting there going, the King was right all along.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Who is this Anna lady? Get rid of it.
Oh, no.
I learned on a completely not serious topic that the simple polka can be received as well as dancing your heart out.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think that scene is not so much about the technicality of the dance. It's about the meaning and the passion and the moment of them
connecting and coming together.
And also
her dress is pretty damn amazing.
One moment where none of their battle is involved. They're just completely... He's just King Mongkut. Remember how to pronounce it. And she is just... And they are just two people having a dance and having a hell of a good time.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's definitely a euphemism, right? It's an allegory, that dance, right? Definitely. It has to be. You're both looking at me with these, like, headlines.
No one knows.
It has to be.
It's all unwritten, Zane.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where they just go, take from it what you will.
That's the point of an allegory, to give you plausible deniability. Other lessons? Or shall we move on to cast?
That was
me. Oh, it's gone.
Okay. Well, if it comes back, you can write in on social media.
Okay. Thank you, Zane. What? I'm sorry. Just while the music was playing, I glanced down at this notes page that's open, and it says Rodgers and Hammerstein initially sought Rex Harrison to play the this is the second amazing part, supporting part of the King. The King is the supporting role. How do you feel? Rex Harrison?
Look.
Culturally inappropriate.
Yeah, but also 1950s. There are much bigger problems in musical theatre at that time than Rodgers and Hammerstein trying to make Rex Harrison the King of Siam.
Rex Harrison,
that didn't happen.
Rex Harrison played the King of Siam in a 1946 movie also based on the book that had nothing to do with the musical.
Yep.
Unfortunately, he was not available, and we're all grateful.
Yeah, that unfortunately is an editorial.
Yul Brynner isn't much better, but Rex Harrison.
I think Yul Brynner brings something to the role outside of him being Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
I think Rex Harrison in that role is just Rex Harrison in that role without shoes on, I guess.
Yes, that's it. No shoes.
Do we have Dreamcast for King? I don't have a Dreamcast for King.
I don't, but because he's already been taken. And I, like, always growing up, I used to see actors and I go, gee, I reckon that person would be good to do that show and that person would be... And I saw Ken Watanabe from Japan, who I thought, when I saw him in The Last Samurai, I went, oh, that guy would be really good as the King. And then he was the King and took it from me.
It took it
from me before I even knew this was going to be something that I needed to think of.
I'll let you have it.
I'm
saying that on behalf of KB, who isn't here, but I'll let you have it.
The guests are always allowed to cast whoever they want. Ken Watanabe is probably my pick for my favorite King, even though, like, I haven't really sat down and listened to all the different recordings.
Yeah.
My dream cast for Anna is Julie Andrews. I didn't know that she did a studio recording.
She's done a studio recording.
I just thought that she hadn't done it. And I was like, this is, I think, a young Julie Andrews. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's very interesting that you deleted Sound of Music while talking about King and I. There's kind of a lot of parallels there.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Is. Yeah. Except there's no wedding.
Except there's no wedding.
No wedding.
Yeah. Or Nazis.
Or Nazis. So. Well, the British are the British Nazis. British kind of,
They're that nerd. Yeah. A little.
Yeah, a little. Look, I was excited to see the movie, The Anna and the King, with the more recent one had, oh God.
Chow Yun-fat, that one, and Jodie Foster.
As Jodie Foster, yeah. As Anna. And I looked at it and I went, oh yeah, Jodie Foster as Anna. I was totally on board. And I didn't hate the movie.
Okay, well, that's a mediocre recommendation.
It needed more songs, but...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Did they get a chance to do the polka?
Can she sing? Because I'd be happy for her.
I don't think she can.
Okay, well, never mind.
I feel like I've heard her try to sing and it's like Nicole Kidman levels. Like she can carry a tune, but she doesn't have a lot of power.
Oh, I just had an awful thought about Nicole Kidman playing Anna.
I think in a different timeline, there is a reality where Nicole Kidman might have played Anna in The King and I, like a couple of years after Moulin Rouge, if it had been made. I can definitely see that.
Definitely at the time, yeah.
I don't think Zac Efron's in this musical.
Yes, he is. As the old flame. Yeah. Who is actually a friend of Anna's. Anna is a widow.
Yeah.
Just in case we hadn't brought that up. Anna is a widow, and a friend of her husband, her now dead husband, is like, oh, hey. Hey, Anna. Haven't seen you in a while. When he turns up to Siam. Like,
I mean, yeah. you
lay off it. That's your friend's ex, like your dead friend's wife.
You judge that, but then you also really like Bridgerton. And it is all about those little incestuous friend groups of like, oh, I'm courting and I'm courting as well. And we're both best friends. And she's choosing me. Oh, no, she chose the other chap.
Have you watched Bridgerton?
Look, I breezed over it a couple times.
Yeah, no, that's not exactly how it happens. But I'm with you.
Yeah.
I still think it was rude. And Anna doesn't like it. Anna's like, cool story. Okay, bye.
Oh, yeah, no, of course. Like, especially Anna wouldn't be about it.
No. Anyway, but I think Zach could play that role.
I mean, fair, like that's a
he only
big
has
part,
to
really?
Pop in the second act.
Yeah.
He can be a sailor in the beginning, which I think would be nice. He can pull some ropes about.
Running with like the short sleeves and
yeah, nice.
I mean, sure, like let's just objectify him a little bit more.
No,
like,
just in the first act.
Now that he's definitely listening to us because he's in the country.
Yeah. Hey, Zach.
Any other must-haves for the cast?
You know what? The role of the king's right-hand man.
Yep, the Crowler home.
The Crowler home. I want to see that made a comedic role. I want to see a comedian step in and take on that role with and just give it a little bit more of an edge of I'm a ridiculous person, right?
Ken Jeong as the Crowler home.
Sure. Yeah.
I was looking at that as an option.
Because he is a very serious character in the sense of, you know, he doesn't want this education and change here. Yeah. He's very
he's the British from the other side of things.
Yeah, but that's the thing. He's so British.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
John Cleese as...
Just when he gets him to walk off the boat, he can walk this way and goose step off.
Yes.
Oof. I mean, that's the thing. Rodgers and Hammerstein write authoritarianism in one way, and that is a British way.
Yes.
So I think that's the translation, the issue of translation there.
Yeah. I do think it's weird in the writing that the Crowler home isn't more subservient to the king. Because he demands it of everybody else that they're subservient to the king, but he himself is not, you know, rushing in and laying on the ground. And
we've all met that person.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, it's basically like the Jafar.
I more kind of feel that he was probably there when the king's father was the king, and he represents that old school mentality, that old school part of the king that he can't let go of.
Kings come and go, but the Crowler home's forever.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I've never looked at it like that.
Yeah, he's still the Krala home when the prince takes over.
All right,
easy
well,
though.
Let's take a short break and we'll come back with top fives. What top five list would you put it on, Miranda?
Top five, in inverted commas, oriental musicals.
I would say exotic musicals. I don't mean to take away from the Asian setting. I mean musicals that are set in a place that's meant to be other.
Yeah.
I don't mean specifically set in Asia. I mean there was a bout of shows where that the oriental style
aesthetic
became very popular.
Okay.
And this is sort of at the end of that era of shows. And really I think the fascination with that probably started even back at turn of the century. Mm. But it had hit this very popularized period in the 40s, and it's a very classic representation of that. Less so in the more recent revival, which is Good News Tick.
Yeah, yeah. Good News Tick.
Good News.
Thank you.
Tick.
I honestly probably going to put Yul Brynner in top five iconic characterizations.
Yes.
Like if you think of the king, you think of Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
Yes.
The end.
The end.
I do like Ken Watanabe's king, but when you say the king, Yul Brynner is the one that comes to mind. Maybe Idina Menzel as Elphaba is on that list.
Oh my god, because Idina Menzel never played the king.
Straight away.
No, I would watch that show.
But even so, Idina Menzel's Elphaba is a character, is a type that has been constantly recast in that role, which is what also happens with The King and I. But it's really what identifies her character, I would say, is actually her in that makeup and that look and that... I think it's more connected to that style than specifically
I mean, her. Even when it came to Brisbane and we watched the show, watching the characterization, like, I got a lot of Idina from just the way that it was presented by somebody else.
Yeah.
Okay. In the show. And, like, you could pick the differences. But, like, yeah, that being said, like, when I think Elphaba, I think Idina Menzel.
Yeah.
And that might just be
same.
Me.
Yeah. That's the same. And he really did, having done the film too and so many productions, he really did set up this is what the character is.
And does.
This is how he behaves, how he stands, how he, you know.
People expect it done a certain way.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone's going back to research footage of original Kings of Siam. Not that that would exist. But, you know, people take that as... this is what it needs. Yeah. That stance that he does with the broad legs and the hands on his hips in fists.
Yeah.
It's so it.
What would you say if I was to put it on the top five, like, accidentally sensitive musicals?
Well, I don't think it was this is what I'm saying. And, you know, when you consider that there were script treatments that Rodgers and Hammerstein had written that were taken out of the original because they were being too political you know, and then put back in now that we're saying, no, that is the point they were making.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was accidental.
Well, yeah, I know that the intention was to examine, like, Culture Clash, which is another top five Culture Clash musicals.
Sure.
But I think just the fact that, like, they have other texts that are less sensitive than this leads me to believe that whether it was them specifically or just the team that had creative input or the people were saying, no, that's too political, that sort of thing, despite those things, it did come out more sensitive than perhaps they were intending, or at least it held up better.
It has held up better.
And I don't know what else goes on that list.
there's some controversy in this show about a song that's performed by the wives when they're being dressed in the in the English, in the Western gear. And the head wife sings the song along with the other ladies about how ridiculous it is, basically. Yeah. And they do a lot of making fun of, oh, you know, these cute little Asian women wearing hoop skirts and they don't know how to walk in heels and, yeah. and things and, yeah. And calling it ridiculous and making fun of it. And there's a lot of people who think, oh, that song is so inappropriate and it should yeah. be removed from the show. And but it's very specifically making that point
yeah.
of yeah. saying yeah. this is ridiculous that we've yeah. that we have to do
that,
this that or that
we
we're
have
doing
to
that.
Do this, yeah.
And in fact Lady Tiang doesn't. Mm. She doesn't dress in that stuff. Yeah. She you know. So that's Western People Funny is the name of that song. And it's in a sense parodying, but also not just being really yeah. outright and saying.
I think it's a parody of the makeover.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
of what came to be called a makeover.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
But saying, you know, Western people came into these exotic cultures and went, oh, aren't they funny? They're doing all yeah. these funny little things.
yeah.
Whereas, you know, she's saying Western people do all these
all
weird,
these funny
little
things.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
So the purpose of that song and is entirely to say, to shine the mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would never take that song out of the show. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that that song isn't in the movie is because, you know, it was a bit
yeah.
offensive, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking yeah. maybe it was viewed as offensive to Westerners.
Possibly.
Yeah, when they took it out of the movie, they were like, oh, this is a part of the storyline that we don't need because yes. it's the part where...
It points out our yeah. our casual racism.
Yeah.
I
it's
think
calling out racism.
I think it definitely is meant to do that. I think it could, depending on the way that that
the
scene is
done.
Portrayed, it could definitely
depending
make fun
on
of the people
way,
singing it.
Yes. Yeah. So, top five shows that need to be performed...
Top five
with
nuanced
intention.
Shows.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
yeah.
like
yeah.
this show does have a lot of nuance because a lot of very much musicals are like, this is the story yeah. and this is the message.
Yeah, they just sledgehammer you with it.
Yeah, whereas this is like the more you dig, you'll find a different layer of like intention and message and yeah. and again, depending on your interpretation and where you're from, you'll view it in a different way.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that goes back to what you were saying at the start, Miranda, when you found that review that was talking about it and saying that they've, you know, they've come at it from a different perspective and
yeah.
approached it in a different way, trying to make it yeah, more real.
Yeah. That article describes it as, initially says, you know, it's remembered as a lush and exotic large-scale musical about an improbable romance. But this musical is not about romance or love. In actuality, it is a battle between sexism and racism, a battle which no one wins.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
yeah,
I think that's an interesting take on it. And to have started from that point and said this is a story about people and culture,
yeah,
would make a very different production to somebody coming in and saying this is a story about a king and a teacher.
This
and,
is the story yeah. of a widowed teacher who finds herself whisked away to foreign
yeah,
lands.
To foreign yeah, lands. Foreign that's lands. The thing. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other top
five? Well, I would have put it in a top five of possibly needs an update, but it's more along those same lines of that
it's the treatment.
It's
about not necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
the book is really good. Mm. I don't say that about a lot of Rodgers and Hammerstein shows.
It's true.
Top five Rodgers and Hammerstein.
I was wondering yeah. if you were going to put it on there. I don't have strong opinions about what goes on there, but yeah, I think
definitely
this is
on there.
This is probably close to the top for me.
Yeah. I also really love the movie of this film of okay. this.
The movie. Yeah. Of this
I
film.
Love the film of the movie of the show. So I think that the movie does a really good job of keeping the spirit of message of the show, which the movie of Oklahoma did not do. Just to cover that. So top five. Conversions to film, maybe.
From stage.
Maybe.
It's definitely on one of my top five, just personal.
Mm.
I love it. I've yeah. always loved it. It's always going to be in the top five somewhere.
There's a special place for your first show.
Yeah,
there's always
exactly.
a special place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's true. That's actually true. Like, my first show is not necessarily a very well thought of show, but I love it. The end. Mac and Mabel.
I think a lot of people who have done Mac and Mabel really love it.
It's but we're talking shows. About... King and I, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Yeah.
Any other top five lists? Are there any songs in the show that should be on top five lists? Ooh. Like Getting to Know You?
Getting to Know You is very well known, particularly in our Getting to Know You segment. there is a... Look, the music in the ballet sequence mm-hmm. is somehow my favourite song.
Okay.
Okay. So the music throughout that performance includes vocals, mm-hmm. singing, and a lot of vocal percussion, and those vocalists play some percussive instruments, and the way the music of that whole section is put together and runs along, like tells the story of that.
Yeah.
I think is also well done and wonderful to listen to and beautiful to watch, and that whole moment in the show is spectacular and it's meant to be spectacular.
Yeah.
At first I objected to having to sit on stage to watch it, because I don't like that idea of having to sit and be watched watching something.
Yeah.
But also I really just would rather be off stage.
Yeah.
Just relaxing for... How long is that ballet?
Oh, feels like an hour.
20 hours.
It's 20-something minutes. Yeah. At least 20-something minutes.
It's like half the act, pretty much.
Yeah. And to just sit there that whole time felt like... In rehearsal, it felt like a chore.
Yeah.
It felt like oh my God, I could be off getting a drink of water, a cup of tea, or... but once you're in that your costume and you're sitting, and then you just get to sit down. You get the pleasure of sitting and watching it every night. I really appreciated that moment in the show.
Yeah, I was exactly the same. I was like, oh God, why do we have to do this? But yeah, then being able to sit and watch it, I was like, yes, this is great.
Yeah.
And it's funny, like that was... So as I was growing up, I was always like, what would I want to do? Play the king, or be, is it King Simon in the ballet? And I thought, oh, especially growing up as a dancer, I was always like, oh, that's what I want to do. I want to do that one. But no, I decided to chase the king instead.
Good job. I do also quite like the king's puzzlement, which then Louis and Prince Tudor
Hongkorn pick up later. That is the Rex Harrison number of the show.
That's the Rex Harrison one.
Like that, that's, even when Yul Brynner's doing it, like I can hear Rex Harrison doing it at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good number. Clever lyrics and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is that the end of top fives?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the end of the show. So thank you very much for bringing King and I. Well, I didn't want to push you too much, because I know you love the show, but we are over an hour.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everyone.
I'm gonna have post show depression after this all over again.
Well, is there anything coming up for you that you would like to plug? Or?
Oh, look, I would love to be plugging stuff that I'm doing, but unfortunately, because of my knee.
Of course, yeah.
People may not know, I've just had surgery on my knee. I'm out for a little while, but my tap group is doing a performance in Ipswich it's called Switch Summer Sounds on the 30th of January at the Ipswich Civic Centre in the early evening. And also, like, we're always at Eat Street. So
yeah, awesome.
If anyone's keen, just keep an eye out on either our Facebook page, those tap guys, or on Eat Street's Facebook page. They always tell people when we're on. So
yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And good if you time. Want to find out more about us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. Send us an email at musicalstaughtmepodcast@gmail.com if you have any corrections or strong opinions that you would like to share.
We love corrections.
But we already threw out Sound of Music, so
that's true. We didn't rake any muck over Julie Andrews this episode, so I'm sure we all be fine. And if you want to become one of the best people in the entire world, become a patron of ours at patreon.com/musicals taught me everything I know, and you'll get some extra content just for you.
I will sing you the entirety of the score of The King and I. Randy and I are just going to record it now.
Okay,
is
good.
That okay?
Do
is
it.
Allowed?
No, please do it, because we are still a long way away from me dancing the Necronomicon.
Okay.
So do that. If you want to find out or listen to any of the other shows that we've already done, which is about 170 of them, you can find us on iTunes and Spotify and give us a rating and review. And until next time, keep talking and watching and listening to musicals, everyone. Thank you very much, Raindit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Miranda.
My pleasure.
I've been Zane C. Weber. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.